Thank you very much, Junwoo, for the introduction and for inviting me to share some of our research with you today. Yes, we'll talk about clocks and precision measurements with very cold molecules. The volume is okay? Yeah, okay, great. I'm visiting from Columbia University in New York. In case you haven't visited us before, we're kind of in the middle to northern Manhattan. This is Pupin Labs, which is considered a historic building by the American Physical Society. We had some interesting things happen over the years. So there's a picture of Fermi in the basement running his isotope separation cyclotron. More relevantly, maybe to my own field, I Rabi spent many decades of his career there, and that's actually where the idea for atomic clocks was born originally at Columbia. Now, being at a very historic building has its disadvantages. So in order to get our optical tables in, they had to use a crane and get them sort of in through the window. So it's not very practical, but fortunately it's all set up by now. Good, so I mentioned clocks in the title. So let me start with a plot that you might have seen in other contexts before. This is a plot of how atomic clocks have improved over the last few decades, where on the vertical scale, the lower number means better precision, lower uncertainty. So first we can look at what we call microwave clocks. These are clocks like our cesium time standard for the SI system. So it's kind of steadily gone down to part in 10 to the 16 over the last few decades. More recently, people started working on optical clocks, which also use generally cold atoms that are either trapped in optical traps or charged atoms in ion traps. And these have experienced a very accelerated improvement over the last few decades, even crossing below part in 10 to the 18 precision, where you can really use these devices to detect general relativistic effects at a sub-millimeter scale. So there's been really great progress. You will also see some kind of intermediate frequency infrared, which generally corresponds to molecular clocks, which these ideas were used in some early clocks, but then things shifted more toward atoms. But in this talk, I'll show you how we sort of picked up the molecular clocks, made a measurement that it's sort of in its first generation, improved from old results just by virtue of using very cold molecules in a very precisely controlled environment. And specifically, it uses, I call it a vibrational lattice clock, because for the quantum states, we use pure vibrational modes of the molecules that are held in an optical lattice. So this is sort of a picture in time. We can also look at the picture in frequency space, where, again, you have microwave clocks that are based on hyperfine transitions in atoms, like in the cesium time standard, kind of 10 to the 10 hertz. And then on the higher end of the frequency spectrum, we have optical clocks that are sort of 10 to the 14, 10 to the 15 hertz. But in between, there's sort of a dry area where there are not a lot of atomic clocks. So conveniently, molecules have their rho vibrational spectra that fall kind of in this region of sub-optical, so kind of infrared frequency domain in the terahertz. So that's where we are kind of exploring this new frequency regime using molecules. Okay, so I also mentioned that we would like to build our clocks that are based on ultra cold molecules. So how cold is it and why do we want them to be that cold? Well, the basic answer is that we want to want them to be cold enough so that we have control over all their quantum states and their motional states. So there are many energy scales inside the molecule, from the electronic binding energy, which in Kelvin corresponds to tens of thousands of degrees, down to vibrational energies, which could be hundreds of Kelvin, down to somewhat lower rotational energies, which could be in the kelvins, and then some molecules have hyperfine structure. And importantly, so we want to be below all of these scales in order to control the quantum states. And moreover, we want to hold the molecules in optical traps. And for realistic laser powers at which we construct these traps, their depths can be order of tens of microkelvin. So that sort of gives us a temperature scale of about a microkelvin where we want to have our molecules. So that's sort of that's sort of the intent. Okay, so here in the next slide, I'll motivate the clock through some more scientific questions. So the simplest way to think about one of its applications is to look at testing Newtonian gravity at very short scales. So Newtonian gravity is very stringently tested at large scales, and by that I mean anything from galactic size down to millimeters. But once you get to something that's much shorter, like a sub-nanometer, then at least laboratory experiments are really lacking because it's very difficult to control masses at such very short range. So a typical way to think about a modification to Newtonian gravity would be to introduce a hypothetical Yukawa-type interaction that has a strength constant A and a typical length range I call lambda over here. And so such a potential would impact the interaction between the two nuclei in the molecule because they're just two vibrating masses. So you can visualize this by kind of visibly exaggerating this strength A to something that you can see, and for a couple of different length scales showing what it looks like, and you can see that it actually causes deviations from the potential, and with sufficient precision, you can be sensitive to that. What I want to demonstrate is that if we look specifically at vibrational modes, then they're very well suited for experiments of this kind. So if you look at the molecular potential and its quantized states, which is what I call the vibrational states, if we can control the molecule to occupy a specific vibrational state, then that corresponds to specific bond lengths of the molecule. So if you, for example, if the molecule is in this state, then its wave function will be peaked around the distance where the star is, kind of its outer classical turning point. So for each vibrational state, there is a characteristic bond length. And if we can run the clock based on a variety of these vibrational states, then we end up exploring a range of lengths, which is important because this is an R-dependent, a length-dependent force. You'll also notice that in this particular test, the forces depends on mass squared. So it would be nice to also vary the mass, which if we choose the molecule smartly, for example, in this case, our molecule consists of strontium atoms. Strontium offers several isotopes that we can use, and we can make different combinations to effectively explore a range of masses, therefore enhancing this type of experiment. So just to show the experimental capability that we currently have, it's a kind of a sample projected exclusion plot that's based just on a single isotope shift measurement between two possible, so using just two possible mass combinations, which is out of six possible ones that we can choose. You can see previous molecular experiments. Hydrogen molecules here. Hydrogen is more tightly bound, so it samples shorter distances. And hydrogen is calculable, so this method relies on direct QED theory comparisons to experiment. Then on the other side, probing longer distances is an ytterbium molecule, which is not very calculable, but here they used only weakly bound states, which have some universal character. So that's a bit of a less sensitive method, but the constraint lies over here. And with our method, which is vibrational isotope shifts of molecules that are either deeply or weakly bound or anywhere in between, we can cover the intermediate range. And this kind of sample curve just shows a precision that is already attained in the experiment. So that's already exists, except that this assumes that the theory of isotope shifts is done at the same level, which is not yet known, and it's currently being worked out by our colleagues in Poland. So just to say a couple of words about that, kind of a nice thing of this feature of this experiment is that really kind of pushes forward quantum chemistry calculations. They're doing new things just to kind of see if we can use our data for this kind of constraint. So basically, to connect molecular clocks to the fifth forces, one needs to understand very well what these energies are, right? How to quantize this potential. First one starts with a Born-Oppenheimer approximation, which separates out the different energies, the electronic, vibrational, and rotational. The latter we don't have in our case. That gives you the rough potential, but then one has to go to higher order terms beyond the Born-Oppenheimer and add the mass-dependent terms that have different physical character, so so-called adiabatic, which depends on the first power of the ratio of the electron to nuclear mass. Then you have non-adiabatic. Then you have various relativistic and QED contributions that have different orders of the fine structure constant. And of course, you have the finite nuclear size corrections. So this is currently calculated by this grad student, Oleg Bozniak, in Warsaw. And the idea is that if we did not do isotope shifts, then one would have to understand this potential basically ab initio at the level of experiment, which, as you will see, is better than part in 10 to the 13, which maybe is achievable for a molecule like hydrogen, but this is out of reach currently for a heavy molecule like strontium-2. But if we do isotope shifts, that would help remove the largest terms that are not mass dependent, and then the pressure on the theory is reduced by quite a few orders of magnitude. This may be achievable much sooner by our theory colleagues. A bit more detail on how you would actually derive this kind of limit on the Yukawa shift. This is again this representation that helps you convert from a vibrational state. So we have about 60 vibrational quantum numbers in the potential. You can convert them into bond lengths, which shown here in units of Bohr radius. So the deeply bound molecules are very tight, and the loosely bound molecules have very long bond lengths. And these red bars roughly show you the size of the molecule. And so this useful chart, these are actual wave functions. They're not schematic. This chart helps you convert the expectation value of the Yukawa potential, which, as we know, is distance dependent, convert it to one that just depends on the vibrational quantum number. Yes?
I
Weak interactions. I think we're not considering weak interactions right now. I don't have the exact answer to your question, but
I don't know the size of them. I just wondered.
Yeah,
small things, but
yeah. So we are looking just at mass-dependent terms. There are no weak interaction terms that are included right now that are mass-dependent. I assume there would be smaller. Great. So then we can find the expectation value of the Yukawa potential, not just as a function of the distance, but explicitly as a function of the vibrational quantum number. And then we can plot these So for example, let's take the most deeply bound one. We expect this to be the most sensitive because the two masses are very close to each other, and so the force is the strongest. So this one has the biggest shift. Just to get some actual numbers, I assumed the current laboratory limits, which is some value for A. So just for the sake of this plot. So the biggest dependence is for the deepest state, as we expect. The weakest is for the most loosely bound, because here the masses are separated. They don't interact as much. And then there's one kind of intermediate one here. So the measurement protocol would involve measuring, let's say two transitions to the blue and to the orange, maybe using this black state, the V0, as the anchor state. And we would measure that for one isotope, which is the solid lines, and the other isotope, which is the dashed lines, and take the difference. So that's the isotope shift. And when you take the differences, here they are shown for both orange and blue transitions. If this is in kilohertz, the differences are much smaller, but they're in tens of hertz. And as you will see from our experimental results, tens of hertz is already much bigger than the resolution that we currently have. So that is another way to see that we do have the resolution to be significantly better than other laboratory limits at this length scale. I'll just mention that in general, isotope shifts have been a popular way to test fundamental interactions, but so far in atoms, not in molecules. In systems like ytterbium atoms or ytterbium ions. So the idea with the atomic isotope shift measurements is that one thinks of the isotope shift as having two major contributions. One is the actual mass shift, and the other is a field, so-called field shift, that depends on the nuclear charge radius, because the charge radii may be different between the different isotopes. And then this nuclear charge radius is not very well known, being measured maybe by nuclear scattering, which is not super precise in all cases. So then ideally one would remove it, and there is a way to remove this by using enough isotopes. And if you use enough isotopes and measure a couple of different transitions, then you can plot the shifts, isotope shifts for transition one versus isotope shifts for transition two. That gets rid of the unknown nuclear charge radius and gives you a line. And that line is called a King plot. And then at the end, if your data doesn't lie on a line, then you know that either something is missing from QED or some nuclear physics, or else there's a new physics that's missing. Generally, in atomic experiments, these King plots test for interactions between neutrons and electrons, sort of by construction. Our method of using molecular isotope shifts is kind of a new way to test a bound state QED in molecules and search for new physics that comes from interaction between the massive nuclei. And while the King plot methods for atomic experiments have been kind of worked out over the last few years, we would need to work out a similar analysis method. In molecules, we have a lot more transitions. Like I showed you, each isotope has 60 clock transitions. So it can be a very multidimensional kind of type of King plot analysis. So that has never been done before. And as we get more data, we'll have to work this out. Another question is, well, which molecule would you use? So we use strontium, but maybe there's a better one. Generally, there are two requirements. One is the molecule should be ultra-cold, just so we can have a very high measurement precision, kind of clock-level precision. Secondly, we would like the ground state to have no electronic or nuclear spin because of theory complications, so more tractable theory. And so if we combine kind of the ability to laser-cool the molecular constituents with a spin-zero ground state, then we end up with these kind of group two atoms out of which we can make molecules, or similarly group 12, which have similar kind of two electron structure, and ytterbium is also similar. So these are kind of helium-like laser coolable atoms. All of these have been laser cooled. Now there are a couple of other desirable properties. One is that we would like to have a large range of stable isotopes, and that's because since we're doing isotope shifts, the bigger the the mass difference that we can get, the more sensitive the experiment is. Secondly, we would like the atom to have fewer electrons because the theory would be more accurate. Generally, the last two are in conflict with each other because the larger the range of isotopes, generally the bigger the atom. So one has to find some sweet spot there. Anyway, these eight possible candidates, between the eight possible candidates, we plot in blue is the group 2 dimers, and in red and black is the group 12 and ytterbium dimers. The latter generally show better sensitivity, largely because they have many isotopes, but also the theory may be difficult, they may be difficult to track theoretically. So we still prefer these alkaline earth metal dimers, specifically strontium is the solid line. One interesting case is calcium, which is just very similar, just slightly better than strontium. So there's not a big benefit maybe in terms of sensitivity, but calcium has about only half as many electrons as strontium. So we can imagine that ab initio theory could work out better for calcium, maybe as a future project. Yeah, you had a question.
I'm just wondering why do you want helium-like atoms? So alkalis are going to be bad because you don't have enough isotopes per species, but it's still a closed shell. Like, what more do you get out of the helium-like constituents?
We also have each, with the even isotopes of these alkaline earths, there's zero nuclear spin. Each isotope doesn't carry any nuclear spin. So that seems to be a benefit. Having nuclear spin does complicate the theoretical interpretation. So that we've been so far staying away from things that have nuclear spin. But
I was wondering more like, is there something electronic structurally that makes you?
Well, yeah. So, the molecular potential of this kind of molecule, look, it's a singlet sigma. For the alkalis, you're not going to have just a single potential, right? You're going to have a mixed, you're going to have a triplet potential as well.
Worry about mixing between.
Yeah. So this is chemically the simplest thing that you can have is a single potential that's not mixed with any other, that literally doesn't have any spin or quantum numbers, which seems to be the simplest. But I think once the first version of theory is done, maybe we'll have a better sense of what is acceptable, what other complications we can have. Yeah, we don't really know. So for now we are doing strontium. It's a reasonably good choice. It's a little heavy, so calculations are difficult, but we'll see where this gets us. A little bit about how do we make the molecules. Well, we laser cool the atoms down to a microkelvin, which is a standard technique. And then we use a photo assembly or photo association, which means just shining some light onto the colliding pairs of strontium atoms, which connects them to a bound molecular state. And then by emitting one photon, they end up in the ground molecular state. So with this process, we end up with a starting point of microkelvin temperature molecules. Even though there's a lot of binding energy here, it's released into the outgoing photon, so the sample is not heated. So we start with microkelvin and we end with microkelvin. We have proven this for the dominant isotope strontium-88 dimer, and we expect it should be easily adapted to the other isotopologues. So just a cartoon of the experimental procedure in case you're curious. It's fairly standard for this type of experiment. We have a hot atomic beam of strontium that's going to a center of a vacuum chamber with some magnetic anti-Helmholtz magnetic coils and a light from all directions to laser cool and trap first on the strong blue transition, and that gives us a millikelvin sample of strontium atoms. Then they get switched to a narrow optical transition in the red. And that gives us the second stage cooling gives us a microkelvin, which is cold enough to be held in an optical lattice, which is this focused beam that's running through. So then the atoms just collect there in the center. We switch off the cooling and trapping beams. But then we need to make molecules. So we turn on this photo-associating light that creates couples atoms at this very low energy to a molecular state, like I showed in the previous slide. And that's really our starting the state prep or the starting point for any experiments with molecules. A clock experiment or any other measurement would introduce some probe laser that generally would excite some of the molecules to another state. And these either decay out of the trap or we don't see them. So to detect, we need to count the molecules that remain here. And this is done in the last step, which generally involves the reverse of making the molecules, which is breaking them up. Counting these atoms via fluorescence. So we just shine a very large blue beam, and these atoms can fluoresce, and we can then count them. We can just image and count how many are left, and that would be one experimental cycle that lasts, the whole thing lasts for about 1 second, and then we can repeat the measurement. You might ask, why do we want to break the molecules before counting them? The reason for that is that, yes, we can just directly image the molecules by trying to observe molecular fluorescence, but generally each molecule scatters just one photon and then it ends up in some other row vibrational state and you get a very low signal. But if you first split the molecule into atoms, and then you can image the atoms. Each atom can optically cycle multiple times, and then you get a lot more signal and a lot better signal-to-noise ratio for the imaging. So that's why we undo the molecule creation process in order to count. Even though I don't have time today to discuss this, I'll just show in one slide that we actually spend more than a couple of years being very interested in this process itself, which is photodissociation of state-controlled molecules at ultra-cold temperatures. And although photodissociation is a very standard tool in chemistry, this is the first time that we really can have perfectly state-controlled molecules, and we can prepare them in a certain vibrational, electronic vibrational rotational state, and even the Zeeman projection of the state. And then we can dissociate with a specific polarization of the light. So for example, for a particular state preparation and pi polarization of the light, we can then image and observe these kind of cool spherical harmonics like Y42 squared in this case for this particular choice of quantum numbers. And so these are really macroscopic spherical harmonics that we're seeing. They're like a fraction of a millimeter. Or we can change the polarization of the dissociating light from pi to sigma, then you're creating a couple of different outgoing states, and then you can see actual matter wave interference patterns for the outgoing strontium atoms. They look like this, like non-cylindrically symmetric patterns that are superpositions of different spherical harmonics. So we spend quite a bit of time on this, but as far as the clock goes, we just use it as a tool just to break the molecules and then count them without paying attention to the specific patterns that we generate. So that's sort of the preliminary story, but I'll show you a little bit more detail about the concept of how the molecular lattice clock actually works. So conceptually, as we already know, we take molecules in the ground electronic state, and we can use any of the bound states. They're all very long-lived, and they all can be clock states. They're coherently coupled by two color light, like this. And as we probe them, they're sitting in this optical lattice, which is a periodic optical trap. And a key requirement on an atomic lattice clock or a molecular lattice clock is that your clock states see the exact same depth of the trap. So this is called magic trapping. This is a way to prevent positional decoherence of the clock state superposition. And this is super important to create a trap that really allows you to have the same depth for both clock states. So how can we design that? The only control we have over the trap is its wavelength, because both states here have no angular momentum, so there's no polarization control. So how do we pick the wavelength? So for that, I'll just briefly show you a bit more detail. Here is, again, the clock state in the ground state potential. The orange and the blue are some vibrational states that are coupled by these two-color Raman probes. But the molecules are sitting in an infrared optical lattice, and its frequency is shown with this thick yellow line. And there are many molecular states here, so I just chose the closest intermediate state, marked it in green. So again, let's just look at the states, the clock states, and this auxiliary state. Generally, if you put both of the clock states are polarizable, which means if you put them in an optical trap, they will stark shift down, which means they are trapped. But generally, they're trapped by unequal amounts. We want to equalize these trap depths. So what we can do is we take the lattice photon, and we can tune it around this green line and use just the right detuning to use the stark shift between the green and the blue states to push the blue state up just by the right amount to make it match the trap depth of the orange state. And then once it's matched, then we have the magic conditions, and the superposition lives much longer. We can observe it directly. So when we hit this magic point, we should be able to see the coherence of the clock transition increase dramatically. So that's exactly what we do. So we can vary this lattice around, the energy of the lattice photon, which is here on the horizontal axis. And then we can track the trapping depth of this blue clock state. And we expect it to show some dispersive feature as we go through the resonance. And at the point marked with this bar is where it happens to match the trap depth of the other clock state. So this would be the magic point. And we can check for it by actually looking at the clock resonance width. And away from the magic point is not that great. It's some fraction of a megahertz wide. But when you get to the magic point, it's improved by several orders of magnitude. So you can see a very dramatic reduction in the line width.
You may have said it, and I missed. How do you select? How do you make sure? Because presumably you wanted to use more than one molecule. So how do you select, make sure that every single one is at the same state? It looks like it's a dense ladder of states, right?
Well, our preparation when we make molecules from atoms.
Yeah.
The preparation scheme sort of by construction creates molecules mostly in, let's say, this orange state. And then everything is very dependent on the laser frequency. So, I mean, the states are spaced by quite a large amount. So we can hit exactly the state we want. It's totally state resolved.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
By the way you build the molecule, automatically most of them come out in one state.
Yeah, because we don't want them spread over many states. Otherwise, you wash out your signal. So it's mostly in one state. There are a few molecules running around in the wrong states. We haven't worried about them too much, as long as most of the molecules are in the state we want. So we do observe this great improvement in coherence at the magic wavelength. So the clock resonances don't look great when you're not at a magic wavelength. They're sort of asymmetric and not kind of broad. But then at this point, I zoom in here, and we can narrow it down to 10 hertz. And this is out of the full frequency, which is about 30 terahertz, which means that the quality factor of this resonance is about 3 trillion. And that's an improvement by four orders of magnitude compared to a non-magic lattice frequency. And I'll just point out that this is still completely technical, you know, based on how well we can control the lifetime of the states and the lattice, because the pure lifetimes of the vibrational states would give a really enormous quality factor. In this molecule, the vibrational states don't like to decay, so they have a really huge lifetime, and we are limited purely by technical issues. Okay, so besides looking at the very narrow resonance, a complementary way to prove that we have very high coherence in this magic trap is to drive Rabi oscillations or some kind of coherent oscillations between the clock states. So the molecule would be flopping between a short bond length in a deeply bound state and a long bond length in a weakly bound state. And then we can use Rabi pulses to at varying lengths of pulses to show these oscillations. And these oscillations can live for, over 100 milliseconds, which is more or less consistent with the line widths that we observe. And there are currently two limitations. One is collisions between the molecules. We currently don't protect them. So when they collide, they react and disappear. That's one issue. The second one is the lattice light does scatter from the molecules. So eventually that erodes reduces the population and erodes the coherence. But anyway, so that's we are currently at this level of about 100 millisecond coherence, a few trillion quality factor. So when we talk about a new clock, even though that's an experimental thing, but it's very important, is to ask, well, what is the how precise can we make this clock? In other words, what systematic effects from the environment can decohere it? What can cause the frequency to shift? And here is just kind of a cartoon picture of the effects that one should be thinking about in this kind of experiment. So one obvious thing is the lattice laser light, because you're doing an experiment in a very bright optical field. So obviously its presence can perturb the levels. Then you have the probe laser light. It's usually very weak, but it can still perturb the frequency. Then you have something that you can't get away from, is black body radiation from the surrounding containers, surrounding walls, usually at room temperature, unless you go through extra efforts to make it cryogenic. So that stuff is always there. Then you have collisions, because it's not one particle, right? It's many particles. Then you can have magnetic fields somewhere in the environment that can perturb your frequency. And finally, you can have Doppler shifts. So if things are moving, you perceive the frequency to be different. So fortunately, the last two are not a big concern at this point. Our states are completely spin-free. They're very insensitive to magnetic fields. As for the Doppler shifts, again, we are doing the experiment in these lattice microtraps, and we make sure to probe along the tight confinement axis of the lattice. So the motion in this direction is quantized, so you don't have Doppler broadening. And so that's basically completely eliminated. But the other effects are still there, and we had to work hard to quantify them. So let me just show you a couple of the more interesting ones. So lattice laser light, that's very important. And that's something that we can't get away from. We need that lattice to pin down the molecules to remove the Doppler shift. But yet, it provides kind of a bath of many photons that the molecules are continuously seeing. Let's just look at the effect of the lattice on the clock transition. So as I mentioned, we want to operate at a magic wavelength. So one way to prove that we are at a magic wavelength is to vary the amount of lattice light that you have in the trap and look at the clock transition shift, which is on the vertical axis. And the different colors are just symbolic for changing the wavelength of the light. And for different wavelengths, you have different shifts. And for the magic one, you have a flat line. So the shift is zero. So that means, okay, we have the magic wavelength. In other words, the clock resonance doesn't depend on fluctuations of lattice power, which is where we want to be. So this is a pretty coarse plot. See, the units are megahertz. So we want to take this wavelength and varied by a much smaller amount. So really zone in on this magic area. So that's what we do here. We zoom in. So now the shifts are much, much smaller, and we're looking at the hertz level. But when you zoom in, the picture changes, because now you don't just have these linear shifts, but you also have very obvious nonlinear shifts. At this level, you can see them very well. So it's a quadratic shift in a lattice. In other words, we have not just polarizability, which is the linear part, and which we can extract separately here, but you also have what's called hyperpolarizability. That's the first nonlinear contribution. So I guess for the first time, we were able to see them in the molecules, because these vibrational hyperpolarizabilities are small, so we need a lot of precision just to see them in the first place. So that sort of ruins your magic lattice idea a little bit. Technically, magic means zero polarizability. So when the linear part is zero, so that would be this orange curve marked here and also here. But because of the quadratic shift, now you have a slope at the place where we tend to operate the lattice. So we don't want to be on a slope. So instead, we choose a slightly different lattice wavelength where locally there's no slope, right? It's kind of locally flat here. This way we construct an effectively magic lattice just around the operating point, but it's not perfectly magic. In any case, this happened to be our main limitation for the both precision and for the accuracy and also the coherence time of this clock. But even this one we resolved at about 4 parts in 10^14. So that's the dominant contributor to the uncertainty. So I'll show you one more that was kind of new, because no one's looked at it for molecules before. And the question is, how does black body radiation that's everywhere, how does it affect vibrational modes of nonpolar molecules? Right, they're nonpolar, so generally low frequency fields do not affect them very much. But of course, we have a very high precision, so at some level, we have to worry about it. So to answer this question, we designed an experiment to actually kind of benchmark it, to measure it. Everything around this ultra-cold trap is actually at room temperature. So the black body radiation we see is at room temperature, 300 Kelvin, which corresponds to about a 10 micron typical wavelength. So we didn't have a 10 micron wavelength, but we had a pretty long wavelength available of 2 microns. So we decided to look at what happens to the clock experiment when we shine this additional laser beam at the molecules called the Stark beam at this long infrared wavelength. So just to give you a sense for the different wavelengths, again, here are the two clock states in the ground electronic state. They're coupled by these red arrows, which are the Raman light. They're sitting in the infrared optical lattice around 1 micron, which talks to some states here. And then the Stark beam is 2 microns, and that in this area there are no more molecular states. So it's really a pretty good way to mimic what black body radiation does. It's long wavelength, so that there are no resonant effects taking place. And for this experiment, again, it was interesting to go back to this picture where you can represent different vibrational states as molecules with different bond lengths, because this visual effect helps us make intuitive sense out of the result. So with the Stark beam, we were able to measure molecular polarizabilities at this very long wavelength for different vibrational states, which we can convert to different bond lengths according to this diagram. And we see this kind of physically interesting result. So this line here, which is around 15 or 20 Bohr, is called Leroy radius. So that kind of marks the distinction between so-called chemist molecules and physicist molecules, where the physicist molecule is really two atoms that are just loosely bound, and chemist molecules are two atoms that are more chemically bound, and their electron clouds overlap. And so for a physicist molecule, there is not much polarizability beyond sort of that of two separate atoms. So there's nothing going on here. But when you go to a more deeply bound molecule, we find that it gets a lot of additional polarizability, as you might expect, because once it's deeply bound, the density of states becomes much, much greater. And so not only we were able to measure it, but the blue line is an ab initio calculation done by our other colleague in Warsaw, Wojciech Skamorowski. And the agreement between ab initio and measurement was within a couple of percent. So this excellent agreement gives us a very good confidence on the ability to understand black body radiation shifts, which are not so much at 2 microns, but more like 10 microns. And anyway, so that constrains our black body uncertainty to a few parts in 10 to the 16. Okay, so we talked about most of these, except for probe light shifts and collisional shifts. So we also, I won't show this here because that was more routine, but we had to also quantify them. And again, we were limited by the first one in this case. This few parts in 10 to the 14 tell us how precise our clock currently is. But it's also important to relate it to some known frequency, to determine its absolute frequency. And what that means generally is to compare it to a primary or secondary standard. So we compared the molecular clock frequency to the cesium time standard. And for that, we didn't have really great infrastructure, so we did it in a kind of primitive way. So all the devices in the lab were referenced to a local commercial rubidium clock, which is not very stable. And then we also had a GPS antenna on the building roof that could obtain some signals from the international atomic time. And then we had a time interval counter that would receive timing signals from the local clock and from the GPS receiver. And then we post-processed it to kind of figure out the actual absolute frequency of this molecular transition. And you can see on the kind of sample data that the small error bars are our systematic and statistical errors, and the big error bars stem from this comparison. So the comparison is not as good as the intrinsic precision of our clock, just because we didn't have a very good metrology system to do this with. So we only got the absolute frequency to about part in 10 to the 13 here. But even with that, it actually makes for a very competitive secondary standard at this kind of dark window of terahertz. So this diagram shows a variety of different the primary standard, which is cesium, and a whole bunch of secondary standards, which are very well characterized. So taller bars means better, like smaller uncertainty. So we have various optical clocks. But here in the terahertz, there's a few molecules, but nothing much. So even if we put our current strontium there, it's already very competitive in that frequency range. What I talked about today was using pure vibrational transitions in nonpolar molecules because they're so precise and can be so narrow. But just to briefly mention, actually molecules offer a lot of narrow transitions, some of them that are unique to molecular systems and are not available in atoms. And we've explored at least one type before. So this was from older work that we did. Instead of looking at terahertz transitions that are driven by two-color light, here was just a single optical transition to a very long-lived molecular state, also in a magic lattice. So in this type of transition, we could also get long coherence of a few trillion. We showed very long lifetimes of these states of about order 10 milliseconds. And the reason we had these very long-lived states that are absent in atoms is because of actually effect called two-body subradiance, which you always have in homonuclear diatomic molecules. So if you imagine a molecule built of a pair of strontium atoms where one is in the ground state and one is electronically excited, there are a couple ways you can write down the superposition here with a plus SP plus PS or SP minus PS, and they have different molecular symmetry. So this one happens to have an opposite symmetry to the ground state molecule. So it decays very readily, actually at the rate of two of a single atomic decay, two gamma, with an electric dipole transition. So these are the standard molecular lines that you will see. But there's another family of lines where this superposition has the same symmetry as the ground state. So the electric dipole transition is completely forbidden. It's strictly missing. So you won't see those lines. But you can still see them very weakly because of the higher order decays. So you can have magnetic dipole or electric quadrupole. So these lines are about four orders of magnitude weaker than the standard ones. And if you have a lot of resolution and if you're in a magic lattice, you can see them. So that's what we were able to see. And that's why we had these also high Q optical transitions that I showed in this slide. So it's just one type of transition that was very interesting to investigate because they are not available in atoms and kind of lead to interesting physics. But there are a lot of other narrow lines and molecules that no one's seen before. All right, so just before finishing up, I'll mention a couple of other projects we have in our lab. I think I already alluded to this a bit. We are interested in different aspects of ultra-cold chemistry, particularly photodissociation in the quantum regime. And we've done some experiments on that already with the strontium molecules. We also have a laser cooling experiment where we laser cooled new both bosonic and fermionic molecules, specifically calcium hydrogen and calcium deuterium. I'm also a member of the Centrex collaboration where we use heavy polar molecules, thallium fluoride, to look for a proton EDM and test fundamental symmetries. Okay, and I just want to thank my research group for working hard on these experiments. So Con Leung already graduated, but he contributed a lot to the strontium experiment until last year. And Robert Mashinsky and his group are our collaborators on the ab initio calculations for the molecules. Okay, thanks.
So I guess first question from students. Could you explain again why you chose strontium over some of the other atoms that seem to have other, more precise schemes?
Right. Yeah, it's not very clear what is the best choice. Strontium is great because it's actually very convenient to laser cool. I mean, it's very friendly to laser cooling, and also it's a very good atomic clock atom. So if you want to, for example, forget the cesium comparison and just compare the strontium molecule to strontium atom, that's sort of available in the same vacuum chamber. So that just gives some convenience. But even if you were to choose from scratch, you know, also I have experience with strontium, so that just made sense. But even if you just chose from scratch, looking at these curves, I wouldn't really, at this time, I wouldn't go with any of these, like barium or all of these. Maybe rather messy for ab initio calculations because they have out of order orbitals and some of them have just a whole ton of electrons. So for starters, you want maybe one of these three that are less sensitive but less painful to calculate. Magnesium here is a bit less sensitive, and also I think it's a bit of a pain to laser cool, although it's possible. So then your strontium or calcium probably your best choices. And as I said earlier, you might actually choose calcium because I think the calculations could be better. But strontium is a pretty solid choice as well. Yeah, sure. But I mean, I'd want to see, you know, how far theory is. I mean, they're doing their first calculation, so we want to see what the limiting factor is. I think changing the calculation to calcium would be a little bit less expensive than changing the experiment, so maybe we'll do that first.
What's it on this chart?
What is
A?
Oh, A is just the strength of the new force in units of big G, of Newtonian gravitational constant. Yeah.
So in the photon disassociation part, like you create these nice interference patterns. I wonder if it's just useful to test the tools, like how precise you can do this quantum control, or you have like some other succeeding potential applications for that, to use it for sensing or to...
Oh, for the dissociation? Well, I mean, we did a lot of kind of, yeah, fundamental studies with it just to... There has been a lot of work back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s that described quantum resolved photodissociation and made predictions, but they couldn't quite achieve it in experiment. So it was really fun to go back and compare our results to what they were writing about a few decades ago. But also, one application that I see for us currently is I showed that we have this other project where we laser cool new molecules. This here. Right, where we laser cool, for example, calcium hydride. So we have laser cooled it in one dimension, but if and when we succeed to laser cool it in three dimensions, one thing I'm thinking would be nice is to demonstrate dissociation of this kind of more deeply bound molecule than strontium-2, and then you could maybe show a new method of obtaining ultra-cold dilute gas of hydrogen or deuterium, which is very difficult to get by itself. So something like that could be an application.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great talk. I was wondering if the laser that you use for probing, so that's to break apart the molecules before measuring their states. Do you have to worry about changing their states in that process?
For the dissociation, it's also very controlled. So yeah, you change the state from a bound state to a broken up molecule. So you definitely do change the state, but in a very controlled way. So you always end up just with two ground state atoms that then you can image.
Oh, okay, I see.
Yeah, yeah.
And I had another question about what kind of ab initio method operators use.
Depending on the term, maybe I'm not an expert to answer this question, but they use, they try to use state-of-the-art methods that are possible for many electron systems. The coupled cluster, doubles, triples. I can look it up for you. Yeah, exactly.
Thank you.
Sure.
So one last question. So what would constitute a signal for a big force in what you showed in the beginning? How would you know?
Right. Yeah. So that's really not a worked out problem. So like I said, for atomic isotope shifts, they have this King plot method, which then they look at deviations from linearity. How we will actually process the data is not completely known yet. There could be many ways to process the data. It depends how many isotopes we measure. It depends how many bond lengths we measure. So the sample constraint plot I showed was done just for one transition in two isotopes. So that's the bare minimum. But of course, we have access to many transitions. And I don't know how we will analyze the data. It's not really a solved problem. But one thing that's nice is that, so I said the theory has to be precise to about part in a million for isotope shifts, which somewhat unlikely for this big molecule right now, but it can be probably compensated by the fact that we have hundreds of transitions between the different isotopologues in different vibrational states. So we can measure more transitions and reduce the pressure on theory. How exactly, I don't know, but I think we can compensate. And also, since you have these different bond lengths, right, you can imagine that if you're missing some QED term, maybe it'll have some dependence, some power law dependence, right? Or for example, whereas if you have a Yukawa term, it might have a different exponential dependence, right? So if you measure enough internuclear separations, then you can start distinguishing between the different terms. But it's a little bit fuzzy right now. Yeah.
Well, I have a question about the same thing that these squares.
Yeah.
Yeah, you mentioned the Yukawa. Okay, could you test other type of forces? I mean, you know, we work on a model where you have like some kind of Friedel oscillation.
Some kind of what?
Friedel oscillation, like the thing that you have in condensed matter.
Mm-hmm.
That you have kind of, you know, modulation, Coriolis modulation. There's so
like time dependent.
Friedel oscillation.
Like, but not rapidly oscillating.
No. So would you be able to test different kind of?
I mean, I think so. Yeah, the constraint I showed just assume a Yukawa term, but
yeah,
you can assume something different. If it varies in time rapidly, that would be harder because it takes a while to average down. But if it's static in time, then you can put in different. You can put a power law or anything like that.
Thank you.